Valley WGN.
Good evening, everyone. Was it fun watching the royal wedding? I loved it. I loved every minute of it. I loved watching the wedding. I liked watching the repeats. I loved the sermon. I loved the gospel singing. I'm not sure, though, I loved the dress. Some say Meghan Markle's dress was splendid in its simplicity. Then some say it was too plain and unadorned for such a magnificent ceremony. But perhaps we can all agree she was a beautiful girl and that she could have worn a bag over her head and she still would have been absolutely beautiful. But I want to talk about wedding dresses. If there's anyone who knows about wedding dress design, style, and fit, it's my best friend Kathy, who is a graduate of the Fashion Institute of Technology and who's been designing and fitting formal wear for over 35 years. Kathy, welcome to my show. Oops. Kathy? Hello, Kathy. Kathy? Nope. Okay. Well, I'm going to just talk a little bit while we're getting Kathy on the line. I wonder, did you like the dress? Was it too simple?
I thought the dress was very elegant. I didn't expect to see a train that long, especially since she walked up the steps by herself, dragging the train on the steps.
That seemed a little awkward to me.
Where
and she
was,
had those two little boys, which,
but they didn't take it until they got up all the way up into the church.
Yeah.
And okay. Not that I wear trains on a wedding dress all the time.
But you would look good. I've seen you with the tiara, though, Roger.
Yes. Every so often I take that out and I just relish in what could have been.
Kathy, are you on the line?
I'm here.
Okay. Hi, Kathy. What did you think of the dress? You've been doing this for so many years. You've probably fit thousands and thousands of brides over the years. What did you think?
I have. Well, I thought it was pretty simple. Very basic dress. Super conservative. I thought that a reception dress was much better. It fit her style, showed more of her personality.
So if you were to change, I mean, obviously you listen to your bride. You don't do what you want to do because what you like is irrelevant to your bride. But if you had your druthers, what would you have done to that dress to make it a little bit better?
Well, the simple seams could have been enhanced by just a couple of design changes, and it would have made her figure even better.
It seemed to me that she was a tiny little thing, and that looks good in a wedding dress, and that it could have been, without being form-fitting or overly sexual, it could have been just a little bit more following her curves. Is that what you're saying?
Right, and I don't think it fit her very well.
Yeah.
I think it could have had a little bit more nips and tucks to make it fit better.
Kathy, in all your years of doing wedding dresses and formal wear, do people know what they want? I mean, do they come in saying, here's what I want, and how do they come up with the ideas?
Well, a lot of brides these days look on social media and see recent weddings, such as Meghan Markle's, and they want a dress like that. But that's not necessarily what's going to look best on them.
And so is it very common, though, for them to think it's going to look good, they put it on, and then they realize it's not for them?
Right. So that's why you need to go to an actual bridal salon, make an appointment, see the sales associates there, and they will help you out. They'll pick out dresses. That's their job. They've done it for years, so they know best.
And what's the biggest challenge when you design dresses? What is the thing that is the most concern to you?
In actuality, it's all friends, relatives, moms, sisters, their influences. That's the most difficult thing.
Because everyone's got
a
different
idea.
Everyone's got a different idea of what looks good.
Right.
What happens when, I mean, brides to me, when I've seen people get engaged, they either start losing massive amounts of weight or they're so nerved out by what's going on in their bridezilla that they actually gain weight. So how do you take into account those things when you're fitting a bride for her wedding gown?
Well, first I talk to the bride. The bride has to have at least 3 months before the wedding where she's going to be steady with her weight. If she's going to lose weight before that. And if weight gain or loss happens, for the most part, dresses can be taken in and let out.
Okay. But there's only a limit. I mean, if you can't take it out past the seams, and then you're going to have to get very creative, right?
Right. So, yes, and I have been quite often, actually. The manufacturers for David's Bridal, they give you huge seams.
Okay.
I don't worry about those dresses. But the higher-end designers, they don't give very big seams.
Do you actually have to pay thousands and thousands of dollars for a bridal gown? Because that's, it seems to me when I watch those shows, Jerry is actually addicted to Say Yes to the Dress, so he makes me watch it on Saturday mornings. But, I mean, these dresses, you know, they're starting at $2,000 or $3,000 and go way, way, way up.
Right. Well, again, David's Bridal is very reasonably priced. There's all different types of price points. It's because of the fabric the dress is made out of, if it's custom, or if it's just a dress off the rack. It can vary anywhere from low end of $500-$600 for a nice wedding dress.
Yeah, and then you can actually adorn it if you want. I mean, you can buy it off the rack, but you can hire somebody like yourself to put sparkles on it or whatever you want, right?
Right, or change the neckline. You know, if it's, they want a sweetheart and it's straight across, I can do something like that.
Interesting. How do you like working with brides over the years? It's got to be difficult. It's got to be very stressful because they want to look perfect. And, you know, not every person is going to look perfect on their wedding day.
Right, right. Well, everybody has different figure types. So you have to pick a dress that's right for your figure.
And if you don't have a perfect figure, there's ways to hide it and disguise it, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So
that's why you hire me.
That's why you hire you. Kathy Vitan Designs, you can be reached where?
My business line is 847-669-3050.
Thank you.
Or you can message me on my Facebook page.
Kathy Vitan Designs. Thanks, Kathy. Take care.
Sure. Thanks.
You're listening to the Karen Conti Show. We're going to be talking about the Laurel Yanni controversy, but we're going to take it from a PhD who's going to tell us why our ears are hearing two different things. You're listening to WGN. Welcome back. The four-second clip heard round the world this week. I don't know, where were you when you heard the Yanni Laurel clip? We have tonight a professor of hearing and science and a professor of neuroscience and physiology at New York University, Dr. Mario Seversky. Hi, doctor. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you for having me here.
And thank you for coming on. Now, we're going to play this in case you haven't heard it this week. I don't know where it started, but there's a word that is said and two different types of sounds, but people hear it differently depending on who they are. And I have to say, the first time I heard it one way and the second time I heard it the other way. And now it's only Laurel to me. But go ahead. Play it.
Laurel. Laurel. Laurel.
Okay.
Laurel.
Okay. Dr. Seversky, tell me why different people hear different sounds when that is played.
Because it's an ambiguous sound. This reminds me of visual illusions. For example, the famous one where you see a vase or you see two faces watching each other, depending on how you look at it, depending on what aspect of the picture you focus on. And this is kind of the same thing. It's not real speech. It's a very poor signal, which makes it easier to be ambiguous. And the thing is that depending on what you focus on in the spectrum of the sound, the first sound may sound like an E or an L. And depending on what your brain decides, which one of the two you hear, that colors the following sounds as well.
Now, why would it be that when I first heard the sound, I heard Yanni clear as can be, and then when someone said, they suggested, no, it's Laurel, then that's all I can hear now. Now I don't hear anything except Laurel. Is there something about the power of suggestion that is making my brain process this differently?
No, it's just that the sound itself is ambiguous, and it's at a tipping point where it can fall to one side or the other, depending on very subtle effects. It may depend on what you've heard before. If you amplify the high-frequency sounds or the low-frequency sounds, that will push you towards a different choice. So there's nothing wrong with you.
Okay.
With anybody who hears Laurel or Yanni, or even with people who go back and forth because they're kind of in between.
Now, What does this mean? Does this mean anything on a broader scale for people like you? And you're in academia and you do research. Actually, you have a very interesting background because you studied electrical engineering and you are now a professor of hearing and science. So obviously, I assume that you are very interested in the engineering of implants, cochlear implants, and things like that. But is there some broader spectrum here that we should learn from this phenomenon?
Yes, this has been very interesting for all of us who want to understand more about speech perception and how the human brain does it. Understanding speech comes very easily to us, but the human brain does it in an amazing way. After we've spent tens or maybe hundreds of millions of dollars on speech recognition, the best software cannot do many things as well as a 10-year-old human. So in the way the human brain does it is by processing incoming speech at a very high rate and trying to find patterns in that speech. So we will hear whatever best fits a given pattern. It just so happens that this word, which is not a human speaking word, it's synthetic speech, it fits reasonably well to very apparently different patterns like Laurel and Yanny. But when you look at the spectrum of Laurel and Yanny, you see many similarities as well.
Which, just in from a gut standpoint, they don't sound alike at all to me. Yanny is a different, complete sound than Laurel.
Absolutely. I find that very interesting myself. But, you know, the sound E is characterized by having a lot of energy around 300 and 2300 hertz for a male speaker. So depending on whether or not you have another peak with a lot of energy in between, that may completely stop sounding like E. If you have that intermediate peak, it may be closer to L. The problem is that in normal speech, usually that intermediate spectral peak is very clear. But in this synthetic version, it's not. It's much more attenuated. So it's very easy to disregard it and focus on other aspects of the signal.
So, Dr. Zaversky, let's kind of switch topics a little bit. I know that you do study in the area of cochlear implants. And again, I'm trying to keep this very basic because I don't know much about it. But when people are born deaf, what part of their physiology is impaired? Is it something in the brain or is it something in the ear? And
there are many possibilities, but by far the most common one is people who are born without working inner hair cells. These cells, inner hair cells, are the ones that convert sound, which is mechanical vibration of the air, into neural activity, into information that can be transmitted to the brain and understood by it. So if those cells are gone, and they can die for many different pathologies, including for genetic problems, then no matter what you do, amplifying sound is not enough because it will never be converted to neural impulses that can be sent to the brain. So that's the most common type of reason why somebody may be born completely deaf.
And that's a totally different reason, a totally different phenomenon than people who are getting older in the aging population who might need hearing aids, correct?
It's different mostly in terms of scale. One can go deaf for different reasons, including reasons of neural origin, that is the cells that are in charge of converting and encoding sounds go away. But there may be other problems too, like more mechanical problems. Like if you have a cold, then your middle ear may fill with fluid, and that can interfere with sound transmission. But when people grow older, we typically lose high-frequency hearing because those same cells die very slowly and gradually most of the time. That's why it's important to protect hearing, because once those cells die, they cannot be replaced.
Got it. Doctor, thank you so much for joining us. And is it Laurel or Yanny for you?
For me, it's Laurel. But I recommend to your listeners that they go to the New York Times website and explore a tool that they put together where you can amplify the low or the high frequency. And I can guarantee you that if you go to one extreme or the other, the vast majority of people will have the experience of hearing both.
Interesting. Thank you so much, Dr. Mario Zaversky. Thank you for joining the Karen Conti Show. Stay tuned. We're going to be talking to Bella Gandy about relationships. It's the Karen Conti Show. Nice to see two very beautiful, bright people in love, Meghan Markle and Prince Harry. And we all watch that. And I don't know, I just get so excited about people living their lives together. And it just seems like such a promising thing for them. They have money, they have prestige, they're going to be doing good things for the world. And it's just really wonderful to see. And I was very happy to get away from school shootings and things like that to watch that. But not all relationships work out, and not all relationships are easy to find, and that's why we have Bella Gandy, who's the founder of the Smart Dating Academy, as our guest tonight. Hi, Bella. How are you?
I'm wonderful. I'm so excited to be here tonight.
Yes, we've been working together and doing some television together, and I'm fascinated with what you do. Can you tell our listening audience what exactly Smart Dating Academy does?
So we teach people the most important thing that they need to learn, which is how to identify partners that actually make you happy, because the person that you spend the rest of your life with, there's nothing more important than that.
Nothing.
So, nothing. Zero.
Nope.
Right?
It'll right.
Determine 90% of your happiness or 90% of your misery. So we teach people how to identify those characteristics and then use online dating and real life to find those people and have fun through the process.
I was looking at statistics on online dating, and they vary, but basically one said that for all people who are dating right now, actively looking for somebody, approximately 40% use online dating. Is that, I mean, that's a lot of people looking to date this way.
Yeah, I mean, if you're listening to this and if you feel like you're the last single person left in Chicago, I promise you, you're not, because the census statistics say that there's 107 million single adults in this country. It's 43% of the adult population. So if at any given time half of those are dating online, 40 to 50%, you've got 40 to 50 million people out there. So if you think there are no lids to your pot, guys, guess what? Get excited. There are, and there are a lot of them.
So again, you know, I was happily married the first time. I was widowed, and I'm happily married again. And I've never been on a dating site. And I guess I just think, why is it so hard for people to find good people? I remember when I was a young single thing, we met people at work, we met people through work, we met people out jogging, we met people at the gym, and it just seemed when people set you up, you went to parties. What is it about now that it makes it harder?
Well, number one, as we get older, right, in our 20s, you know, there's many, many upwardly mobile singles, right? But as you get into your 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, right, it becomes harder to meet people. So I say that my clients that come in that are dubious about online dating, they're like, I don't want to do it. It's for degenerate, creepy people. No, change your lenses. Thank God for online dating, because the pool of people that you could potentially meet is vastly expanded.
If anyone has a question for Bella, I'm sure you do, give us a call here. We'd love to hear from you. 312-981-7200, 981-7200, or text. Bella, how does online dating change the dynamics? Because my thought is this, and tell me if I'm wrong. You know, when you dated somebody in the past, you sort of stuck with one person, and maybe you gave them a second chance or a third chance, and maybe you saw them at work or you saw them somewhere out and about. But now people are online, and so they have five different options, and they're texting all these different people, and they're giving one person a chance, but then they've got someone else on hold for Friday. I mean, is that really fair to people, and does that make it more difficult?
You know, I think what I tell all of my clients, and for anybody listening to this, is assume that people are dating other people, number one, in today's day and age. You're not exclusive unless you've had that conversation. But with online dating, it can create this fallacy of abundance, right? You're like, meh, a date that might have been amazing or even okay 20 years ago where you would have given them the second date. Today, it's like, meh, kind of disposable. I'm going to see who else is in my
right.
Tinder matches today.
That seems very unhealthy.
It can be, right? And that's one. You know, like anything great, I believe in online dating. I think it's amazing. But that is certainly the underbelly to it.
Now, I also read a statistic that like 53% of all people who are online dating lie about their profile, mostly their weight, their age, and their income level. So you kind of have to read it with a shake of salt, right?
Yeah, absolutely, right? They say if men are going to lie about two things, it's their height and their income, and if women are going to lie about two things, it's their age and their weight. So, you know, I tell women that are going on dates, look, you know, you never know. Just make some assumptions in your mind for both men and women. If a guy says he's 5'9", maybe just assume he's about 5'6". So when you walk into the date, if he's actually 5'9", you'll be pleasantly surprised. So just go into this. And again, all of these things, unfortunately, we tell these fibs and these white lies about ourselves because it ultimately comes from this belief, I'm not good enough.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to find someone, you know, and I have 35-year-olds that think that they're way too old, and maybe if I was 31, I'd get more people, and then I've got 70-year-olds that say the same thing. So it's just a grass is always greener phenomenon. Don't lie in your online profile.
No, I that would be a turnoff just because that doesn't speak well of future of honesty with someone who's going to lie about something as basic as their weight or their age. I mean, it just seems to me that that's a red flag. But talking about red flags, and Bella, as you know, I am very involved in the practice of family law. So I see a lot of people who have failed relationships. In fact, my clients all have failed relationships. Otherwise, right, they wouldn't be approaching me unless it's a prenup, of course. But I wonder, you know, how do you deal with someone's past relationships? Because it seems to me that if you've made mistakes in the past, you don't want to make them again, and that you might be prone to doing so. So how do you handle that as a dating coach?
Well, one of the things we do is we really dig into our clients' backgrounds, and not just their marital or dating history, but even how they grew up. What was their parents' relationship like with each other? What was it like with them? What was it like when they were adults? Which can have a profound impact on how we choose our own partners and how we come to a partnership. So we do a lot of in-depth work to put those guardrails around people to say, you know what, you might like narcissistic or emotionally avoidant people because that seems to be your pattern. One of your parents was like this. So we're coaching them on a weekly basis to make sure. We're like skydiving instructors that are taped to our clients when we jump out of the plane so that, you know, we're their extra parachute. So we really make sure that they don't do the same thing over and over.
So let's just say that you're raised with a dad, let's say, who's a narcissist and not emotionally available, as you said. So now you go on a date and you get these little traits and you think, wow, this is just making me feel very comfortable. It makes me feel like I'm with my dad because it's the same personality. How do you shake someone? Because you're attracted to something that's a comfort zone to you, even if that comfort zone is not healthy. So how do you break people of that? How do you have them recognize that what they're doing is an unhealthy behavior?
Yeah, we have green flags and red flags. Like, we have a whole process, and we phase out red flags by dating. Like, what are you going to see as a red flag? What I call phase zero, reading profiles, reading messages, versus date one to date 10, and then date 10 onwards. And what happens at 4 months. So it's really knowing what they're going to be prone to, and then helping them to maneuver those landmines around that. And if we know, we tell our clients, we need to know about this, and the other thing, whatever those are, and we have them journal after every date. If you feel like, oh, wow, there were explosive fireworks and great chemistry, that's potentially a red flag to me right away on date one.
Interesting, because I think a lot of people say there's got to be chemistry, otherwise there's not going to be date two, and maybe that's not the best way to look at things.
Sometimes when there's too much chemistry, what I have seen in our practice is that chemistry is actually familiarity.
Yes.
It means you remind me of someone I've dated in the past, and it pushes that old button again. So when someone says to me, oh my God, I had the best first date last night, I'm like, deep, deep, deep. My antennae are going off. Like, we got to really manage this one.
Interesting. Interesting. We're talking to Bella Gandhi from the Smart Dating Academy. If you have a question here, give us a call. 312-981-7200. This is WGN. We're talking to Bella Gandhi with the Smart Dating Academy. We've got a texter who says, what should you watch out for in someone's online profile to make sure they are real and not a catfish or a scam?
Well, number one, make sure that this person has more than one photo. Or if the photo looks too good to be true, it probably is too good to be true. When you get the messages from these people, even if their profile looks okay and they have one photo, if they're if it seems like it's full of bad grammar and bad spelling, a lot of times the unsavory catfishers are coming from different countries, from call centers. So if it seems weird and the messaging doesn't match the profile, it's definitely a red flag. And anybody who tells you that, oh, you know what, can you do me a favor and just email me at bella@hotmail.com because my subscription is ending tomorrow, that is a red flag for sure, because sites like Match can monitor your activity if you're emailing within the system. But as soon as you pull off and go to somebody's personal email, don't take that bait, because now guess who can watch that? Nobody.
Got it. Now, one of the interesting things I saw in my research was that people, when asked, what are the most important things to you in choosing people online? And the two things were common interests and looks. Okay? So those are the two most important things in making a choice. What do you say to those criteria?
I think that online sites kind of force us into that, right? What are you really allowed to do? Post photos of yourself and talk about your interests. But okay, that's fine. But what I tell people is look at the tone of what someone's saying. Does it seem like someone you would want to be friends with? And most people are going to look better in real life than they do in their photos. So give people a chance. Talk to them on the phone before you actually go out on the date so that you can make sure that this person doesn't have a cyber personality, which is very different from their real personality.
And, you know, looks, let's start with that, because I think there are a lot, let's just say that the idea is that men are looking for people that have a certain look, and there are a lot of women who are not perfect weight, or they're not the most beautiful person in the world. How do you approach dating when you feel like maybe I'm just not good looking enough to hook a guy in this situation? I mean, how do you tell people that looks really aren't that important, or are they?
Look around. Are the only people that you see in coupled, happy relationships size zero supermodels? No. Look, and just be inspired by that. You don't have to be some idealized version of yourself. What you want to do is dress yourself up, look good, and get a good set of photos taken that put you out there as the best version of yourself. And remember, people want to date the person in the picture, so don't have them photoshopped up. But that's the person that has to show up to the date, too.
Right. I mean, yeah, if you post a picture of Marilyn Monroe and you show up, you know, looking like yourself, that to me is just...
Deception.
It's deception. It would make me very nervous and not really able to have a good time on a date.
Yeah, absolutely not. But no, put yourself out there. Just like I always say, that there are many lids to every pot. Love exists for every person on this planet that wants it. And you have to start to believe that for yourself. And love is a when, it's not an if. And if you start to believe these things, and I promise you, if you're out there raising your eyebrows going, I don't know, you haven't dated the kinds of people I have, Bella. I'm telling you, it's true. I've been doing this professionally for almost 9 years. I see happy stories happen to people all over this country of all ages. So love is out there for you.
I got a text from the 708. My experience with Match.com is if the person is sitting on a motorcycle, they're really short. I like that.
That's really funny. I get a lot of them. Oh, if a guy's got a hat on in 5 out of 6 of his photos, he's probably bald. Right.
That's right.
So you hear all of these things. That's interesting about
Bella,
the motorcycle.
As a family law lawyer, I see people who go through divorces, and maybe by the time they get to me, they might be on their second divorce. That's not uncommon. And I'm interested in how people handle these kinds of breakups in their lives. And it doesn't even have to be a divorce. It could be just a long-term relationship. But some people are okay with their breakup, and they're happy to move on, and they're ready to put down the baggage and just move forward. And then there are some people that are bitter, and they don't get over it. And even they think they should have gotten an extra $10,000. They should have not sold the house. Whatever it is, they're bitter. And I find that I just really I'll be surprised if they find someone given that bitterness. Do you see that a lot?
Yeah, I see a lot of people, and not so much with our client base, because I try to do a good job of vetting for people, because to your point, bitterness and anger and resentment that hasn't come out yet, and that PTSD, that has to be processed. And if you have tried therapy and it hasn't worked, guess what? Get a new therapist. It's like a personal trainer. Just because one doesn't work doesn't mean they're not all going to work. But yeah, you need to process and put that anger to bed and get rid of it before you're actually ready to date again.
You were a business person before you started doing this. So you worked for Arthur Andersen, and you worked for a family chemical business. How did your business background help you in this dating and relationship business that you're in?
It helped me to understand what process and procedure were like in virtually anything you want to do. So even in the dating and the love business, you know, I put my own process together in my early 20s to find my own husband, and I helped many of my friends do the same throughout our 20s. They're all still happily married, have kids, and so the business background really helped me to say, okay, what's important in dating and finding love? There is a process, but we're not taught that in this culture. We're taught, what are we taught growing up about love and marriage? It's like, oh, you'll just know when the person's right.
Love at first sight.
Right. No, sometimes you don't just know, right? 50% of marriages end in divorce. We don't just know. So I think having the business background helped me to really say, okay, what's important from A to Z, that anybody can go through this process and find love and get excited and have some fun doing it.
Now, the one of my pet peeves is my friends will say, Karen, you have to help me find somebody. And I'm like, okay, well, you know, better call Bella. But what is it that you're looking for? And these people, and I'll say they're mostly women, but men too, they will pull out a list.
You know,
it's like from a cartoon, one of those big long rolls.
Like a declaration of independence.
Exactly. And he has to be this tall. He has to be of this religion. He has to like baseball. He can't, you know, and it goes on and on and on. And you sit there and you say, that's going to make it really hard to find somebody if you have a list and preconceived notions of who your next husband is going to be.
Yeah.
How do you get people down off of that whole trip?
We have a whole process that turns that checklist over on its head, and it's called the marriage map. So we actually transform that checklist, which, to your point, for most women, it's, I want him to be tall, 5'10 or taller. I want him to be funny. I want him to be sophisticated. He should know how to dress himself. He should have a passport with at least 50 stamps. I mean, the list is bananas, like what we actually hear, which, again, and understand, it doesn't mean you're bad if, you know, those happen to be the top five items on your checklist, but it's also things that we're wired to want from an evolution standpoint, which don't really serve us anymore. So we're kind of spinning around in circles. But yeah, your checklist should probably have 5 to 8 things on it, maybe.
And, you know, it's interesting to get a little bit personal here. I was married happily once, and my husband died, and I'm happily married again. And I look at the two people, and they're so different, completely, totally different about almost every single thing, common interests, all that stuff. But the things that are the same are those real basic trite things that we say, trust and fun and support and all of those things. The Venn diagram that intersects are those things, not the way they look, what, you know, what they like to do on a weekend. Those things are completely irrelevant when it comes to a relationship. And I think, having seen that in my own personal life, I try to get people not to pay attention to that as much.
No, that's really good advice, and you're right. Those are the things that really make the distance. You know, I tell my clients, one of the most underrated human values in marriage and relationship is kindness.
Yeah.
Being kind to each other and having restraint in, after you've been married for a long time, you know how to push each other's buttons, right? And mm-hmm. It's knowing how not to do that. And instead, when you want to say that negative thing, how do you walk away, spend that 20 to 30 minutes apart, and then come back together again, very rational about whatever it was you were arguing about. So,
Bella Gandhi, thank you so much for joining us. Can you tell everyone how to contact Smart Dating Academy?
Go to smartdatingacademy.com, and you'll see tons of videos and information, and, you know, you can ask me any kinds of questions you'd like as well, and I will answer you.
And if you set somebody up and they get married, we're going to have them on the show and give them a little wedding gift. How's that?
Do you hear that, guys? Royal wedding gift.
Thank you, Bella. Take care. We're going to be taking your legal calls in the next hour. Any legal question you might have, 312-981-7200. Welcome back. This is the time to call me with legal questions. I've been practicing law a long time, 31 years to be exact, and I would be happy to point you in the right direction or give you some answers as best I can about anything. Wills and estates, personal injury, family law, criminal law, anything that's on your mind, or maybe there was something in the news this week that you saw and you'd like me to help explain from a legal standpoint as best I can, give me a call, 312-981-7200, or text your questions here. Lines are wide open, and my producer is going to be taking your calls here. So I wanted to talk a little bit about jury duty. I get a lot of people over the week who call me and text me and email me asking me about jury duty. They want to get out of jury duty. They want to know why they keep getting called. What are my obligations? And interestingly, I have been summoned to jury duty on Tuesday. So I am reporting as juror 709-14763 to the Maywood Courthouse at 8:30 on Tuesday. And I had several court appearances that I had to cancel because being on jury duty is a very important thing. I take it very, very seriously. It's one of the only things that our government really asks us to do besides pay taxes, which is nothing insignificant. I don't serve in the military, and I do vote, and those are probably the only three things that you are occasionally asked to do, and so I take that seriously. I also take it seriously because not showing up for jury duty doesn't work. They will hold you in contempt, and if you don't show up, they could bring you in and have the sheriff bring you in, and you could be held in contempt. They could fine you. They could do other things to you. So that is not, you don't ignore a jury duty summons. That's the last thing you do. So some of the things that you need to know about jury duty is, let's just talk about getting out of jury duty. There's a group of people that decide whether your excuse is good enough, and generally your excuse is not going to be good enough. If you're caring for a person or a child who has a disability, you may be able to be excused, but only if there's no reasonable alternative. They will explore, can you get a sitter? Do you have a relative? Can your spouse stay home from work and watch the child? So that usually doesn't get you out of jury duty. If you don't speak English, that might get you out of jury duty. I was asked, I think it was a couple weeks ago, about whether you can serve on a jury if you're a felon. And I wasn't sure. I sort of knew the answer, but I wasn't sure. And the bottom line is that you probably won't be called to jury duty if you're a felon, because it comes from the voter registration. And to be registered as a voter, you can't be a felon. So in some jurisdictions, that's not the case. And you may be called if you're a felon, but you'll probably be excused from service. Yes, Roger?
Sorry, when you mentioned if you don't speak English as a fluent language, doesn't the court appoint or have interpreters in the courtroom?
You know, they can do that, and they do, but if it's going to be a long jury trial, you're going to have an interpreter there for maybe a week or something, mm-hmm. And so I they generally don't do that. The other thing that I have seen, Roger, is someone is really hard of hearing.
Right.
The judge will generally, maybe not at the beginning, like maybe you still have to go, but mm-hmm. if the judge says how bad is your hearing and you can't hear, that's a bad one, because as a trial lawyer, I want to make sure everyone hears me, and I don't right. want them to say that they're hearing me but they're not hearing me. So that's another way to get excused. I do know that there was one time a deaf juror, and they actually brought in somebody to do sign language, which I thought was very interesting, and because you don't want to discriminate against people. You can't discriminate right. against people with disabilities based on gender, based on race, based on age, any of those things. But generally, as a practical matter, because of the chaotic nature of Cook County and some of these courthouses, as a practical matter, you probably will be excused.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah. But just a couple other things. Mm-hmm. You're paid at $17.20, whether you like it or not. And does your employer have to pay you? So, Roger, if you get called for jury duty,
which I have,
would you get paid your $99,000 daily salary from WGN?
Minus $17.50.
WGN doesn't have to pay you.
That's right.
They don't have to pay you. Many employers do. I always pay mm-hmm. my employees who go on jury duty, because mm-hmm. I think, why should I dock them? They're going and doing their civic duty. Mm-hmm. But they don't have to. But they can't fire you for
right.
going. And some employers have done that, and they really can't do that. And I've had judges write very strong letters to the employer saying, you can't do that, sir. That's against the law, and you better reinstate this person, which sometimes happens, sometimes doesn't happen.
Yeah.
But
And then, you have to claim the $1,750 on your taxes, too.
You do.
Yeah.
You absolutely do. And, you know, most of the time, Roger, you're sitting in the room and you may get called to go through the voir dire process, which is asking questions.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of times you don't get called at all. Sometimes there are no jury trials for the day. And so you sit in a room and you watch the film, which is a nice little film about mm-hmm. why you should be on jury duty. And you bring lots of reading materials. Most of the time you can now bring your laptop and a cell phone, bring change for the vending machines.
Exactly.
And like I have a stack of things I'm going to be working on. And if you have an excuse, like for instance, I'm going out of town this week and I have plane tickets, and if they want to put me on a jury, I'm going to have to say, listen, I can't serve more than a couple of days because I'm taking this trip and it's prepaid and they're non-refundable, and I'm bringing them to court in case the judge says, well, I need proof of that.
Yeah.
So you're going to bring proof of whatever problem you have that would impinge
sure.
on you.
And that would be a financial hardship.
Well, it's not just a financial hardship. I don't think they would just call me again. They'd say, we don't
right.
want you to lose
gotcha.
Your $500 or whatever
sure.
it is. And so therefore they'll call you again. But you know, they're pretty nice about it. But the problem is, if they start letting people out of jury duty, then everyone is going to use the same excuse.
Right.
And then they don't have any jurors.
Yeah.
And, you know, Roger, have you served on a jury?
Yeah, I served on one, but it was dismissed that day.
Okay.
In other words, the jury was set. We went through the process. I sat on the jury, and then we came back I think after lunch, we sat for about a half an hour waiting for the lawyers to come back in, and they came back in, and they announced they had a settlement.
Oh,
and
okay.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your service, and we were gone. I also was dismissed from being considered for a jury, because it was a medical malpractice case, and I think at the time I was working in media. I think it was back in the late 70s when I was working at Q101, and my wife is a nurse, and those two combined, they went back in the hallway behind the judge's desk in the hallway behind the courtroom. And for about 5 minutes, and came back and said, thank you anyway, we'll find someone else.
Right. And you never know what the reason
no.
is. But,
yeah.
I mean, even people say, why do lawyers serve? I mean, lawyers serve on juries all the time.
Sure.
Barack Obama got called leader of the free world. But I think that lawyers are going to be very wary in picking a lawyer
mm-hmm.
to be on a jury. And I had a jury once with two lawyers on it.
Ooh.
And I was very concerned because I knew that whatever side they were on, they were going to be leaders or deemed to be leaders among the jurors,
mm-hmm.
and the jurors might look to them to determine, you know, to make those determinations. And I was just concerned that they may have undue influence on the jury. It turns out they did, but in my favor, which was fabulous. but again, I think my chances of getting chosen are very slim, but those are my famous
how
last
many,
words.
they pull a couple of hundred.
Yeah,
people.
They do.
Every day, and then you get split up into four or five different groups, and depending on what's scheduled for the day in the courthouse, a group may be called and a group may not be called.
Yeah, you never know.
Yeah.
You never know. And on Fridays is kind of a slow day because no one wants to start a jury. Things tend to settle
mm-hmm.
at the end of the week. So, yeah, there's all kinds of phenomena like that.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is, if you get your summons for jury duty, you have to go. Don't try to get out of it. Go and do it, and I will tell you it'll probably be a great experience. Give us a call here. We've got the lines wide open. 981-7200. Any legal question you have, you're listening to WGN.
On the side of the law, on the side of the law.
Just want to give a little shout-out. My co-worker here at WGN, Lou Manfredini, has a show called House Smarts on Channel 9 on WGN Television. He's such a great guy. I learned so much. I don't even want to caulk windows, but when I'm done listening to him, I want to take out my caulk, and I want to caulk all day long. Anyway, I am now on his show. I have a regular segment called In-House Counsel, and I will be doing a little segment on issues that are legal that pertain to houses. So this last Sunday, I did a little thing about boundary disputes and in your home, what happens if you have a neighbor who's planting trees or building a fence on your property, what are the things that you should do from a legal standpoint. I'll be talking about construction contracts and warranties and things like that that pertain. And so I encourage you all to watch and continue to watch Lou. He's great. And hopefully my segment will be a hit. Anyway, give us a call here. The phone lines are wide open, 312-981-7200. This is the time to answer legal questions. Let's go to, all right, I don't know, is this Will? Hi, Will. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. My question is about money that I owe a school. I was going to attend a college, and I took out a loan, and I decided not to go. And what they did is they sent me a check for that money. But then when I decided not to go, they returned the loan back to the loan people. And then they put a negative balance on my account with the school. So fast forward like 8 years from then. And now they're starting to call me about it. And I'm wondering if I still owe them the money. I mean, if I...
So did you signed up for the school, you got the loan, you said I'm not going to go, but how far into the semester did you drop out?
Before it started, but they had already given me money for the loan, but see, they returned the loan, but then they put what I owed the school back on my student account.
So the question is, yeah, I see what you're saying. The question is, did you drop out in time to get a full refund? And that's going to be something that is driven by the policies of the school, because usually there's a date by which you have to say, I'm not going to go, and then you get a refund. And as I recall having this issue in some other year in my life, there are different times. Like if you do it right before the school starts, you get a full refund. But if you do it a little bit of time into it, you get a partial refund. So that's something you're going to have to go back and figure out 8 years ago, what was this school's policy? Are you able to do that?
I don't. I think either way, it would be a valid money that I owe them. But
oh, okay.
I don't have the money to pay it, but is there a statute of limitation that goes with that type
of... Yeah, it would probably be a written contract, which is a 10-year statute of limitations. However, if they haven't been making... Or I take it they're not calling you and they're not hounding you, right?
They just started recently.
Oh, they just started.
They haven't done anything until recently, yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, there's not much you can do. I mean, how much is it altogether?
Around $10,000.
Yeah. I mean, there's two options. You could just wait and see if they sue you, and if 10 years goes by and there's no lawsuit, then you win. Or you can call them and just tell them you don't have the money and see if you can come up with some kind of arrangement to pay maybe a couple thousand to settle it. That's my best advice. But thank you for the call, Will. Take care. Let's go to Patrick. Hi, Patrick. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show.
Yes. Good evening. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
All right. A quick question. I guess it's called the LEM law on new vehicles.
Yes.
I bought a Jeep Cherokee in 2015, brand new. And from then until now, I've had it back into the shop five separate times for the exact same problem. Four times, apparently, they found something wrong and fixed it. The last time that it went in, they said they couldn't find anything wrong with it. But now I don't trust the vehicle anymore.
Okay, Patrick, I'm running out of time. I'm going to put you on hold. I'm going to answer it as best I can. Lemon law is a very niche practice. There are lawyers that just do this, and I can give you that referral. So, Patrick, email me at the office. It's wgn@AskKarenConti.com. It generally, my understanding of the law, as I recall, is that it has to be three occasions and it has to be issues with the car that are not insignificant, meaning major problems like engine and carburetor and things that are not just a window that won't go down. And if there's three of those and if it constitutes a lemon, then you get money, and then there are damages attendant to that as well as attorney's fees. So send me your information and I will send you the name of a law firm that does just this. Give us a call here. We got lots of phone lines open. 312-981-7200. Welcome back to the Karen Conti Show. I'm taking your legal calls at 981-7200. A texter said, is the TV show Bull realistic? And I have to say, I have never watched it. I really don't watch television. But my jury consultant friend said that it is very realistic. Obviously, it's a little exaggerated and it's a little dramatic. But the concepts that they use in jury consulting are very, very close to reality. So thank you for that text. And someone also texted by saying, please define what is meant by a peer with respect to juries and the jury of your peers, right? That's what you're entitled to in this country. And what does it mean to be a jury of your peers? And that means that basically the people who are like you. But that has been ruled upon many, many times, so that, you know, peers would mean people of mixed race, people of mixed gender, people from the cross-section of your community where you live. So if you live in a place where you have 50% African-American population, you would technically be entitled to loosely and roughly that same type of demographic. It doesn't always work out that way, and there are a lot of questions about what that really means, but that's my best answer for you. Let's go to Jeff. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show. What is your...
Hello, Karen.
Hi.
Hello, Karen. I want to try to make this as concise as possible. I have a friend of mine, a business associate I've known for like 25 years. He's in a wheelchair. Moved to Florida because his house is in foreclosure. He had a little tiny sailboat in the back, a little sunfish. It's like 14 feet. It's nothing. But in the middle of winter, before I went in for hip surgery, he's begging me to move the boat to the front driveway, and it was full of ice. And a friend of mine helped me move it to the front. And anyway, I put my lock on it, and then there was a sale at another warehouse. And he asked me to pick the sale up because he didn't have a car. He has no car. Anyway, so he owed me $465, and I'm not giving the sale back, and I'm not taking my lock off. The police want to arrest me for felony theft, and I see from the conservation police that I have a right to lien. Not only the trailer, but the boat.
Okay, hold on. One second, Jeff.
Do I need to surrender to the sheriff?
Jeff, hold on. Are you in Florida? Are you in Florida or Illinois?
I'm in Illinois.
Okay.
I'm in Illinois.
Okay.
I'm ready up here.
Okay. Hold on. I'm going to put you on hold. All right. First of all, mechanics lien. He's probably talking about a mechanics lien, which means that if a worker does work on a building or even a boat or a trailer, you can put a lien on that property for unpaid work, okay? But you got to do it the right way. You can't just claim it. You have to actually file it, and it doesn't sound like he filed it. Second is this: he's owed $450, and the police are threatening him? This is not worth it. I don't know why you would not just turn it over to this guy who's in a wheelchair who owes you $450. And again, why would you mess with the police? Why would you mess with a criminal record? Why would you mess with a felony? Then you're going to have a lawyer, and you're going to pay a lawyer $5,000, and that's much more than $450. So this is really a bad idea to make these assertions right now. I think you should just leave this alone and walk away from it. Okay, let's go to Kathy. Hi, Kathy. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show. How are you?
Hi, Karen. I'm okay. How are you doing?
Good. What's your legal question?
My legal question is in regard to my father, who has dementia. We took him to court last year to try and get guardianship. I had already previously been his power of attorney, and we had taken him to a neurologist a couple times, and basically they didn't you know, they didn't call it Alzheimer. They basically said, I forget the exact terminology, but it was something with his memory. And we had seen a lot of irrational behavior over the past year and a half or so. And he had this girlfriend who, once we petitioned guardianship for him, we did that mostly, we were concerned for health reasons, but also financial reasons. And we started suspecting, and then he had some proof that she was forging some checks and other ways of controlling his life.
Okay, and, Kathy, did you get the guardianship?
No, we had a power of attorney. The judge appointed a power of attorney. And basically we did that because we went with this power of attorney and forced my dad to have a neuropsychology test. And he had it, and it showed processing deficits. But long story short, with the guardianship, it never got, after spending $15,000, we never got to the discovery stage.
Okay. So, okay, we're going to get to the end here. So there's no guardianship. The judge did not appoint a guardian. So your dad has a power of attorney, but he does not have a guardianship. So the question is, you want to somehow get him away from this girlfriend and make sure she doesn't cheat him.
No, they're married now, and so we've visited my father a couple times when she's been at work, and now she has sent out a summons basically to my sister and my mother because they visited. I can't even visit him because I had well-being checked
out. You know what? Hold on. I'm sorry, but there's a lot of facts here.
Yeah.
I think what you're going to have to do is email me at the office because there's just too much. This is going too long and too many facts, and I'm not even sure where we're going with this. I know you want to protect your dad. It sounds like this is a bad situation. These are very difficult cases because, especially now that they're married, she has presumptive rights to do some of these things. And, you know, you're going to almost have to prove that there's some sort of elder fraud or elder care, because when they're married, his money is her money, and she's going to get it all probably when he dies. And so the question is, are you going to try to vacate the marriage? And that's something.
Question is simply, if she's saying we're stalking and harassing, can she prevent us from seeing our father?
She can do that. I mean, you know, I think you have to keep trying to see him, but, you know, is she filing stalking charges against you?
She did.
Okay.
She filed criminal charges.
Okay, and now you have to hire a lawyer and go do that. Well,
we did.
Yeah, that's really unfortunate. And, you know what? You're going to have to give me a call at the office because you really need to have an estate lawyer see what you can do as far as getting a guardianship over him and to prove that she's doing things that are not in his best interest. And it's a very, very hard thing to do. So I'm going to give you my email address. It's wgn@askkarenconti.com. That's a very, very serious and sad situation. Give us a call here. We have 15 minutes left, 981-7200. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show. Welcome back. It's Karen Conti. There's still some time here. 981-7200. Let's go to the phones and see if we can answer some legal questions. Hi, Joan. Welcome to the show. Hi, Joan.
Hello.
Hi, Joan.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you. Here's my question. My son was an undergraduate at the University of Arizona. He received a ticket when he was there as a freshman for possession of alcohol by a minor. He had a court date, which he did not make because we had a death in the family. His grandmother died. We requested a continuance. They did not grant it. He no longer goes to school there. What is the statute of limitations on that ticket? And that charge.
Okay, you should hire a lawyer in the county where the ticket was given, because you're going to need to know at the status what happened that day. Because there was a no-show, there could be a warrant out for him, or the ability of an issuance of a warrant. So someone needs to go to the court file, and maybe it's online, maybe it's not, and determine what happened that day, and then find some way to get rid of it by expungement or otherwise, because this is the kind of thing that comes up sometimes when he goes for a job or he applies maybe to graduate school or something, and it comes up that he's got a conviction, and that's something that is going to prevent him from getting work in the future. I'm sure that's what you're thinking about. So there's really no quick way to do this at all. You're going to find a very competent criminal law lawyer in that county, and you hire that person, and first just take a look at the file and see what happened, and then from there your lawyer will tell you what you need to do. Okay, and you're right for looking into it now to get this off his record, hopefully. Okay, all right.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Joan. And it's always important to show up in court. And sometimes young people don't feel the need to do that, but certainly that's not something he should have. Even if there was a death in the family, he should have hired a lawyer to move to continue, and he probably should have followed up after that happened and just not ignored it, because these things pop up, and maybe his license plate will pop up somewhere where he's driving, and he'll be taken into custody, and that would be a horrible thing to spend overnight in jail because of something like this. Let's go to John. Hi, John. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show. What is your legal question?
Well, real quick, your previous caller reminded me of an episode of the TV show House. Okay. Where Wilson still had an outstanding warrant for his arrest.
Okay.
So, because he never appeared.
Yep. It's not a good idea to ignore anything coming from a court, including a summons, a subpoena, or a court date. Absolutely.
Right. Anyway, I graduated college in 1990. I was not able to find anything with my degree in accounting back here in the Indiana area. So, I ended up getting into trouble with credit card debt. I filed for bankruptcy. Unfortunately, the federal student loan debt was not forgivable. Has anything changed since then to make student loan debt forgivable via bankruptcy?
To my knowledge, nothing has even come close to doing that. It's one of those things that's not dischargeable, like taxes. Student loans are kind of written. You know, it's written in all of the bankruptcy statutes that they are not dischargeable. I'm sorry?
It would take an act of Congress to make it forgivable?
Well, they'd have to change the statute. They'd have to change the law of bankruptcy, because bankruptcy law is very complicated, and it exempts certain things that can't be discharged. One of them is taxes. One of them is student loans. Even certain child support is not dischargeable. And these are things that they deem to be against public policy to allow someone to have those kinds of debts forgiven. So, you know, I don't know if there's any other way around. Okay. All right. Thanks, John. Thank you very much. All right. Let's go to Bill. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show.
Yeah, I just want to get back to that jury duty talk you had earlier.
Sure.
And I guess my general question is, why can't a person volunteer for jury duty? Because, you know, I'm a retired person. I certainly wouldn't mind being, and I'm sure a lot of retired people would not mind being on jury. And it's been over 12 years since I was ever called for that, you know. And I'm sure I'm in the pool, but, I know a lot of people don't want to be.
You know, there's all kinds of talk about that kind of stuff, and I admire you that you want to do it and do your civic duty, and it is easier when you're retired and you have time on your hands, and it would be interesting to you to go there, and it wouldn't be a burden, whereas it is a burden to sometimes when you have young children, 3 children under the age of 5, and you can't find daycare, and it is a burden. So, they've talked about that. They've actually talked about having professional jurors who, you know, they hire to like sit on these cases or allowed to volunteer. And that's just never been something. I don't think there's any jurisdiction that I'm aware of that has that ability. And it's, I think, just the idea that it needs to be random. They don't want people with an agenda. Not that you have one. I'm not saying you do, but it could be that someone has an agenda to give people personal injury money or exonerate every defendant. So it would be suspect if you were a person who volunteered to do that duty. But that's a good question.
I did have a friend who was called a lot. He didn't want to be on it, and he told me that when they actually got to interview him, he would say that he was never arrested in his life, and as far as he's concerned, if somebody was arrested, they're guilty. And then he would never get on the jury.
And, you know, some judges buy that. Some of them say, you know, some of them look at him and go, all right, sir, I know what you're trying to do.
Right.
Anyway, well, take care. Thanks for the call. It was a good question. Peter, welcome to the show. What is your legal question?
Yes, thank you. In Illinois, is there a ban on vexatious litigants, as other states have?
You know, I don't think there's a list of vexatious litigants. And I think what, just to explain to our listeners, occasionally there are lawyers and litigants who will file suit after suit after suit and pursuing some issue or some defendant. And they have been found to be frivolous, meaning that there was no basis to bring the suit either from a factual standpoint or maybe the law didn't allow that type of thing. And courts have sanctioned, meaning they have fined people from doing that, and sometimes they even say you can't file another lawsuit unless you run it past us first, basically saying you're on a list of people who, you know, at least in that court, that you can't pursue something without prior court approval. Is there a list somewhere where you can go to and find that? I'm not aware of that. I'm not aware, well, Peter.
California, I called you actually 2 years ago about a person I called a pedofogger. He tried to sue me $50,000 for selling him a T-shirt online because I've been put the country of origin. Long story short, I got dismissed eventually. But they tried to drag me to California saying I had business there, I collected sales tax there, did none of that and so forth. And kind of followed him on the web what he's doing now. He filed another lawsuit, but he did it with, not against me, but against a government entity for age discrimination. And of course, that got tossed out and had me thinking about, well, what if that person came to Illinois or anybody else filing frivolous lawsuits?
Yeah, and, you know, because he's doing it in different jurisdictions, it probably won't be tracked. But there's not a place where you can go to figure that out. Sounds like a loony bin. But unfortunately, in this country, you know, you have to defend it. Because if you don't defend it and there's a judgment entered against you, then there's all kinds of problems on your credit report and the like. But good luck, Peter. Thank you. You know, Jerry, you had a question. You had a question for me before the show started.
Yeah, did I read something or hear something in the news last week that somebody's trying to get the state of Illinois to reinstate the death penalty?
Yeah, interesting. Yes, Governor Rauner had a bill that it was an anti-gun bill. Actually, it was making it harder to get certain kinds of guns. And he added in a provision that reinstated the death penalty for purposes of mass murders and for police killers. And basically it said that instead of proving beyond a reasonable doubt, it would have to be proven beyond any doubt at all. And I got a couple problems with it. The death penalty has been abolished about 8 years ago. As we recall, George Ryan issued a moratorium, meaning everyone who was on death row had their sentence commuted to life. And then several years later, Patrick Quinn abolished the death penalty, as it's been abolished in many states. But, and interestingly, the crime rate and murder rate has gone down. It has nothing to do with abolishing the death penalty. I'm just saying that by abolishing it, there has not been an increase in crime. But that was based upon the fact that we had 12 people executed and 13 were actually exonerated due to actual innocence. And it's funny that you're asking that because I called George Ryan this week and I wanted to talk to him and see if he would come on the show and talk about his decision to abolish the death or to issue that moratorium. And he's not doing any media appearances at this point. But he and I talked about it and he, you know, I have to say a lot of people doubt what he did was maybe genuine and was heartfelt, but I was there when he commuted the sentence for Rolando Cruz and pardoned him, and he told a great story. He said, I was a pharmacist. My family had pharmacies in Kankakee, so my whole life was about helping people with their medical problems. I've always been a staunch death penalty person. I've always been pro-capital punishment as a Republican. But when it came my time to actually be the one who signed the death sentence and to actually say this is the day you're going to be executed, he said, I couldn't do it. I said, I look at these people. They've been convicted by three sets of jurors. They've been appealed to eight different courts, and they're still innocent. And I can't do that. These are not good statistics. And I think that by bringing it back is listen, I'm not a fan, but My concern is by slipping it into this bill, we're not giving it full consideration. I think if we're going to reinstate the death penalty, we should study it. We should have our legislators figure out if this is going to cost more or less. And is it really a deterrent? And are we prepared to do all the things necessary to bring back the death penalty? But that's just my opinion. Anyway, thank you for listening. I'm going to give out my number at the office in case you have any questions, 312-332-7800, or email me at WGN@AskKarenConti.com.